Okay, let's go. Okay, we're back. Sorry for that interruption. Naomi, are you on the line now?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Okay. Sorry about the minor confusion there. So we're reaching out to you tonight. Thank you for being our special guest. I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about who you are and what you've been writing. I mentioned in our introduction that you're coming to us as a mystery novelist. I was wondering if you might tell us a little bit about some of the mysteries you've written and a little bit about who you are right now and where you're located.
Sure. I'm talking to you from Pasadena, California, and where I don't think it's been quite as hot as Portland. But in terms of my background as a writer, actually, I started off as a journalist, but I was always wanting to write fiction. And I had struggled with a novel for actually 15 years, and it kind of morphed into a mystery. And once it was published, the publisher wanted another one, and I'm finishing my seventh in that particular series. And that one has an amateur sleuth who's a Japanese-American gardener, an atomic bomb survivor who solves crimes all over the world, right? The last one takes place in Hiroshima, Japan. And I've also done another one with a bicycle cop in Los Angeles, a woman of mixed ancestry, of mixed race. So, I've also written a number of noir short stories that are darker than my novels. But in some ways it was kind of unexpected for me to go into this particular genre, but I've really enjoyed it, and I've found that it's been like the perfect container for the things I want to write about.
It's really fascinating that you started off actually initially not intending, or at least thinking of going into fiction, but starting with journalism. And I was looking over some of the books that you've published in the past and noting that some of them are very unlikely. you read this and you think, some of the past reference books you have worked on, Distinguished Asian American Business Leaders, 2003, seems a little dry, and yet somehow, you know, we find ourselves, like I think a lot of us writers begin in one place doing something very pragmatic, and find inspiration even in the seemingly mundane.
I found as a writer that I need to always be open to new opportunities, because whenever, even if you go into something that you think it's dry, it's like, oh, you know, the yo-yo was invented by a Filipino, you know, American. I could write about that. And there, it's just things that you constantly learn about. And I think that opens the door to new types of writing. And I think, at least for me, writing, doing research about real people and real events has kind of inspired me in terms of my fiction. And I know one Japanese academic who was like studying my work, she said, oh, you write, you know, even your fiction is kind of journalistic. And at first I took affront at her comment, but I'm very curious about the world and how it works and untold stories. In that sense, I know you usually have poets on your show, and I think, and I love poetry as well, and just like wordsmithing and the language, but I think also for me, what's been important is kind of to look outside of my own experience. So not only the internal experience, but just the external experience of learning about history and politics and all of those things are important facets of what I like to write about as well.
I think I share a lot in common with that. My father was a professional librarian and a family historian, and so a professional genealogist as well. And so for him, it was all about history, and it was all about stories. And so he was always bringing things that he managed. He was the supervisor over an archive of materials related to the history of the Prairie Provinces and the Plains States. And so there's many different waves of immigration, and as well as those First Nation people who had been there before, and all the stories that they had. And so for him, it was just always a wealth of stories that he could come back and share with us. And and I did find, you know, growing up, that with that as a background, then as a writer, I am in a similar fashion drawn to like these unexpected corners of history that are sometimes forgotten. And I was wondering, you talk about your discovery that the mystery was a type of vehicle, a vessel for addressing something that you wanted to get at. And could you elaborate on that or expand on that? How is that particularly helpful?
Well, a couple things come to mind. One, I've really been inspired by actually African-American mystery writers, you know, probably beginning with Chester Himes. And just his use of language, like, I think often the way I describe it, it's so pungent, you know, like the way he describes his detectives and his, you know, Harlem series. And also that there were social commentary. And I think the same goes with Walter Mosley, you know, as he kind of goes through the history of L.A. through his sleuth, E.Z. Rawlings. And I think that those kind of people, I feel, as I was writing my first book, were kind of like walking beside me and kind of giving me like hints of how I could talk about like the Japanese American community in Los Angeles. I had worked at a Japanese American daily newspaper in Little Tokyo. And just so, you know, I don't write about these things because I'm Japanese American, but because I had actively worked in the community and I learned, you know, while I was there, I was learning new things about this community of people that was so fascinating, and some things didn't make sense. And some, you know, I think my own kind of concepts of what the community was kind of broken as I was like writing daily stories about them, or having, you know, reporters write about that as well. So anyway, it's kind of a lot of journalists have become mystery writers. And I think one reason why is we're always kind of questioning the motives of people who give us information, right? Because everyone has an agenda. So in some ways we're kind of suspicious. We're always trying to figure out where they're coming from. And I think another thing is many of us have covered crime at the newspaper or what media outlets. And we kind of see, you know, like from when the crime was committed, you know, we talk to the police or we talk to the victims and whatever. Then it gets to be the suspects, and then it goes through the whole legal process. And I think, as for me, I had cut my teeth on that at the newspaper, so I think I felt comfortable with that. And just more from a writing perspective, there is a structure, you know, in terms of plot and misdirection, things like that in the genre. And I guess some people think in that way it's formulaic, but I think what's interesting is, okay, if there is this formula, how can we subvert it, or how can we put a new twist on it? So, and last of all, it's entertaining. Like people, you know, just, they come to the books because they like a good mystery. And many times, like my readers, they might not know anything about Asian Americans or Japanese Americans. They're just coming to the books because it seemed like an interesting concept, you know. So they won't pick up an academic history book, but they might pick up a mystery. So that's what's so fun about it for me personally.
Okay. We're going to pause for a second to kind of do our show ID. If you're just tuning in, you might be realizing that this isn't Poetic License. They're on break this month. You are listening to Late Night Literary Buffet or Late Night Literary Show. We haven't decided what we're going to be on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Neil Akin, and I'm talking with mystery novelist Naomi Hirahara. Let's get back to our conversation. Naomi, you were just talking about this, sort of the ways in which journalism ends up leading many people into the mystery, mm-hmm. you know, because of the questions and the sometimes the skepticism, sometimes just a general what-if scenario, what if this is really what is happening? And I thought it was really interesting in light of that, I just finished reading Summer of the Big Bocce earlier today, and I was thinking about how there is a journalist, or at least someone posing as a journalist, in the story.
Right, true.
and I thought that was kind of interesting in light of that. And I was wondering if that's a common occurrence. Do you draw then on sort of, are those characters that show up?
There's often journalists in my work, and I usually mention the newspaper I used to work for, too, mm-hmm. in a lot of the works as well. But I think, you know, and we're kind of seeing it, especially right now, just the conflict, right, in terms of the press and mm-hmm. the government or the status quo, you know, there's this conflict that always seems to exist. So I like that. And I guess in some ways the journalist can be a type of detective as well, although I really haven't made a journalist like the main character in any of my books. But, yeah, they slip in, definitely.
There was years and years and years ago in the 80s, there was a TV show in Canada called Seeing Things, in which it was the main character was a newspaper reporter who happened to have psychic second sight.
Okay.
And that, so he was constantly seeing murders and crimes just before they happened.
Oh, wow. And I would have liked that show.
So I thought, you know, I was thinking about that in relation to this. I do love, you know, having just started getting into this series, I've really loved the ways in which, you know, you kind of talk about, you weave in history and an introduction to different aspects of both the Japanese American community in Los Angeles and Southern California, and also just LA in general gets kind of mm-hmm. Explored, especially during this particular period. One of the things I thought was really interesting, too, was the ways, and I was wondering if this was something, I feel like this is a deliberate thing, that in many ways I felt there were conscious choices in the book to subvert or challenge expected ways in which Japanese Americans and Asian Americans in general are typically represented or thought mm-hmm. of in media or in stories or in film.
Well, I I must say that, you know, Mas Arai, the main character, historically it's kind of based on my own father's life. And mm-hmm. so he was a blue-collar worker, he was a gardener, and in some ways that's a stereotype, like some people would say, but that's what actually my father did. And mm-hmm. historically there was a reason why there were so many, you know, gardeners of Japanese descent, like especially in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, they were often depicted in, like, noir movies, like LA Confidential. Well, no, not LA. I think it was Chinatown, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Asian gardener, the nameless gardener. And so one, purposefully, I wanted to give this gardener a name, you know, and more than a name, to make him center stage of a story. I didn't really imagine that he would take up seven books, but but that's kind of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always the pressure, you know. I don't want to be didactic in these books, so I want it to come out more organically, you know, the history. And oftentimes it's why one person dislikes another person, that it's kind of rooted in some kind of cultural, historic reason. And that's how I could kind of tackle some of these layers, you know. I know one older gentleman, you know, he came up to me. He was a Nisei, Japanese-American, and he said, "Naomi, you know, you're airing our dirty laundry," you know, which I thought it was funny. But, you know, later I was thinking that the reason why this genre is so great, even in terms of our community, you know, Asian American community, or in this case, Japanese American community, because at the center of every mystery is some kind of crime. You know, there's evil, you know, that's a given. And I think that some of my Japanese American readers give me a break, you know, because they know, okay, this is just part of, you know, it's a requirement for the mystery. So even though sometimes I feel uncomfortable that it's not a hagiography, you know, I'm not elevating, you know, these people as model minorities. I'm trying to actually show them as real people. You know, I think they kind of go along with it, like, okay, you know, she has to have, like, some bad people in there, you know. It's just part of this kind of literary genre, so they'll accept it more readily, I think, than if it was maybe, you know, a piece of literary fiction.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, the characters are fleshed out in interesting ways that reveal something, like you say, the parts perhaps of the experience of being Japanese American, you know, aspects of the community or the life that maybe aren't always publicized. The gambling, I thought, was an interesting, you know, recurring thing in the first book. And I thought the other thing that was really interesting was sort of this theme of names and reinvention. Mm-hmm. That, you know, some characters have very, you know, unique names that are setting themselves apart from, you know, their Japanese ancestry. They're choosing not even an American name, you know, an American name, but a name that is like some, I mean, there's a lawyer, I think it's a lawyer who's G.I., you know, and others who have very, you know, particular names that stand out. So I thought that whole reinvention thing was interesting. But the other thing that I thought was really interesting were the ways in which, you know, it was just a small moment in the book that I thought was really interesting. But Keiko, the character Keiko who runs the ramen shop, you know, the discrepancy between the voice that is used in the TV ad and her actual voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was also kind of interesting and revealing about expectation versus reality.
Yeah, you know, I get usually one of two responses, like from readers, like in California, they'll say, "This is a world I never knew existed," or they'll say, "Oh, that's like my uncle, that's like my neighbor, you know, that's like my gardener." So it kind of shows like there's, you know, these parallel universes out there, you know, that this is, to some people, a very intimate, personal, you know, very familiar world, and to others, like, they had no idea. So that's the really fun thing And some things like the names, that I think that's interesting what you said about the reinvention, but some of it is like just mirroring what really exists, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of, now they're mostly all gone, but a lot of Nisei when I was at the newspaper with these, that second generation Japanese American, with these really absurd nicknames. So, yeah, I have a wishbone and I have a tug.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of fun because you could use that metaphorically, right, for your characters. But I remember, like, in one of our obituaries, it was for a Nisei woman, and her, in the obituary, it identified her nickname as Porky. And I'm saying, are we going to put this in there? And they go, we all knew her as Porky. It's like, okay. But I think another reason why I like that kind of thing is that people often say, like, oh, Japanese or Japanese Americans, they don't have a sense of humor. You know, they always are depicted as so stoic. And some of that silence is definitely there. But there, I just see a lot of absurdity as well as a sense of humor in just the way they select how to be named, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to reflect some of that in the book as well.
Okay, unfortunately, it looks like our time is already winding down. So I'm going to ask you maybe just two final questions. One is, are there other Asian American mystery writers that you've looked to either as peers or as people that have blazed the trail for writing in mystery?
Well, it's really exciting what's happening. We have, you know, Ed Lin, who his latest is the Night Market series.
Mm-hmm.
He's in New York, and he's also a literary writer as well as a mystery writer. So he's doing exciting things, as well as Steph Cha here in Los Angeles. She's a young Korean American. She's written three mysteries, and she does a lot of literary critiques. So I think that there's, and I was a recent judge for a mystery award for unpublished novelists, and we had some interesting writing from Filipino Americans. So I think something's breaking through right now, and it's really exciting. So I'm looking forward to reading more Asian American debut mystery novels in the future.
I am too. I'm quite excited. I've read some of Ed's books as well, and they're fantastic as well. And yourself, do you have a book that's out or forthcoming that you want to briefly mention?
So it's the final Masarai mystery. It's called Hiroshima Boy, and it takes place all in Hiroshima. And I just finished it. It'll be coming out in March of 2018. And you don't have to have read any of the books to tackle it. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, this has been delightful. I'm so glad we had a chance to talk. I hope we get another opportunity to talk more. Definitely looking forward to reading the rest of the Moss series and the Ellie series with the bike cop.
Thank you, Neil, for having me.
Thank you, Naomi.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. And we're back. Our next guest is poet and scholar Margaret Rhee. Margaret, are you on the line?
Hi. Yeah. Thanks,
Margaret.
For having me.
So good to hear from you. Margaret, would you mind taking a brief moment and introducing yourself, kind of the work that you do, and maybe mention the book that's coming out?
Sure. Well, I am a poet and scholar, as you just shared, and I taught at the University of Oregon in gender studies for the last 2 years, and I will be teaching at the University of Buffalo in media studies. So a lot of the writing I do is on media, race, and gender. I also write about robots, and the new book that's coming out is a poetry book entitled Love, Robot.
Love, Robot, which I've read some of the poems already, and I'm really excited to see this book come out. So a lot of people probably wonder, how does one become involved with writing poetry about robots? Okay, what was sort of the trajectory? What was the impetus for this?
Well, I couldn't say that you were one of my inspirations as well. If folks are not familiar with your wonderful, magical Babbage poems, they should. So... I mean, for me, I'm very lucky to have awesome poets writing about machines and robots and exploring this genre, if you can call it a genre. But yeah, I think when I first started writing about robots, I didn't really have any models necessarily. Long story short, I was doing grad work at Berkeley, and the person next to me was a postdoc in robotics, and we both worked in new media, but at the time I was researching robots, like the cultural history and intersectionality, but, you know, this person, I had a lot of poetry posters and flyers all around, and so he had asked me, who are these people? Who is this poet? And the poet was Langston Hughes. And I began telling him that, and he told me, well, actually, I write poetry too. And so the poet, his name is Dimitri Benerson. He now teaches at the University of Michigan in robotics. You know, was a wonderful poet. And so just knowing that he wrote poetry, as well as, you know, worked in robotics, also helped me think about my own practice where I was researching about robots and writing about them, and also writing poetry, yet I hadn't really bridged the two together. And so that's how I started writing about robots in poetics.
Mm-hmm. What is particularly attractive to you about the robot, either as a subject or... I guess as a subject.
Well, I mean, I think in our current, you know, contemporary moment, the robot is so, you know, it's so representative, right, of everything we're experiencing around technology. You know, scholars of technology often say that it's this current period and, the late 19th century and the industrial and technological transformations in these two periods that have been the most rapid. And so we can see how technology has shaped and changed our lives in our, you know, the way we communicate by social media, the internet, all sorts of different kinds of inventions by way of technology and the computer. And so for me, the robot is a really interesting and an attractive way to kind of ask these questions of our moment, you know, through the robot, that oftentimes may be a way that a writer can be even braver, you know, to ask. So, I mean, like, you know, just more specifically, the poems I write are about love. They're about intimacy and desire and transgression. And so the science fictional world or robots offer a really neat way that we can explore these questions without if it's only in our present moment and between humans where something, something could happen where a writer might want to hide behind that or not be brave enough to ask these certain kinds of questions or describe certain kinds of dynamics. But the robot was a really fun way to describe and also imagine the future.
Yeah, I've had this conversation actually recently with another writer, and they were talking about the fact that they were really struggling to write about some particular personal traumas that they had been navigating. And then they had developed almost an alter ego, a separate character through which they used this third-person character to navigate through that discussion. And they found themselves liberated. They could do things with that third-person character that they couldn't do in a first-person perspective. And I wonder if in some ways, what the robot offers, and often just the machine in general offers us, is a mirror or a means by which we can look at ourselves, but at a slight distance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. I think it is a mirror. I think the, human-machine dichotomy is something that's always been transgressed, right, in certain ways, that we're all not simply all complete human as well as machines are not all completely machines, right? They're created by humans as well as humans being shaped by machines. So in a lot of ways, we're really tied to the machine and robots, as a mirror, as you say. And I think, for me, similarly, like your friend, I wrote a lot about, queer relationships and, issues around sexuality and transgression and societal kinds of attitudes towards it. And so the science fictional world and robots was a really... I think a really freeing way and a neat way to kind of explore those same questions.
For you, are there particular models that you now see or people that you see as peers, like exploring the same type of thing? Like, I feel like in the time that we've known each other, we've both watched as artificial intelligence and robots have really come back into the forefront of like film and literature. They're starting to take more and more of a prominent place. Do you see any particular authors other than some of the people we've already discussed that you feel are really doing this work in interesting ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I started writing the poems, I wasn't very aware of other people working on these particular intersections of robots and poetry as much. But as I began writing them and kind of finished the first draft of the manuscript and I began teaching classes on robots, I began to be very interested in reading through and reading other work. So I think Larissa Lai's The Automaton Biographies was definitely an important work that I read, a wonderful book of poetry that kind of, takes on a fan fictional poetic take on Blade Runner, along with other kinds of human-machine transgressions. Another poet is Jeanine Hall Gailey, The Robot Scientist's Daughter, a really beautiful book about what it means to be the daughter of a robot scientist, but also, she delves into the science fictional and how women can also, become cyborgs, right, in this world that she's created. And of course, as I've mentioned, your work has always been very, you know, influential as well. And yeah, but I think it's still a small community of folks in poetry. I think it's much more common in mainstream film and media, as well as nonfiction. But I think poetry, I don't think there was, not that there isn't as many, I think it's also the fact that people hadn't found each other, you know? And so I think that was a large part of a lot of the, you know, curatorial work that I was interested in doing around machines and robots and literature, was what it means to build a community and how folks can, you know, talk with one another and share work. And, you know, I think the zine that I edited, you know, based on the conference that, you know, we had co-organized at UCLA 2 years ago, was a really great, I think, manifestation of what it is when we have different writers like Janine, like others, such as Keith Wilson, who did this incredible visual poem around Emmett Till and the Uncanny Valley, right? And thinking about these theories of robotics and how they can be applied to understand, you know, contemporary issues around race, difference, and violence.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Late Night Literary Buffet, or the Late Night Lit Show, whichever we decide to go with, on KBOO, KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Neil Akin, and I'm talking with Margaret Rhee, poet, scholar, and lover of robots. So I think one of the people that I think is definitely lurking in the background of this discussion is Donna Haraway and the Cyborg Manifesto piece that she wrote. And I find she writes about, I think when you talked about earlier about how in many ways, you know, we are intertwined with technology and with machines. You know, we carry our cell phones around everywhere, and we rely heavily on the technology in our cars and just all sorts of things just to navigate our life. And then likewise, you know, the machine, the computer, is reliant on us to design and program. We're getting closer to a point where machines do more and more of that creative work. But at the same time, there's an anxiety about how much we relinquish our control over that design and creativity.
Are there, you have
this book that's coming out, Love Robot, and an earlier chapbook. Is this a vein that you think you'll continue to write in past this project?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I think it connects to what you were speaking about in terms of Donna Haraway. After I finished this book of poetry, I did not write any more robot poems at all. And so, you know, the work I've been doing as a poet has been really solely about violence and politics, and so very kind of different kind of work. And it's not that I don't love, you know, literature around robots. I think I just found as a creative person that I had moved on from it, and I was ready to kind of, you know, start something new. I do, you know, I am still working on finishing a book, a scholarly book on robots, which is also informed by Donna Haraway's theoretical work, as well as others like N. Kate Hale's on posthumanism. And so a lot of the kind of robot research I've been doing has been much more analytical and theoretical. And so, you know, I taught a fembot and cinema class, you know, at the University of Oregon. And so it was really great to work with students and just, you know, hear their thoughts on these films that depict women as robots. And, you know, so a lot of my robot writing has been much more around analyzing different kinds of media and kind of understanding the robot and its significance in culture by way of that.
In this process of, you know, studying robots and how they're represented or the role that they play within culture, pop culture, even in how we think of ourselves, have you found that there are lessons that you've learned in this that are transferring even if the subject matter isn't explicitly about technology or robots?
Yeah, if I'm understanding your question right, it's sort of like what we can take away from researching and thinking and writing about robots and how it can be applied to something else.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. Is like, is there sort of a? I guess what I'm thinking is like, if you're a person that studies film, for instance, and then you move on to a different genre or a different field, you can't help often but see the next field that you're in through the lens of film theory and film construction. And you might be looking at fiction, or you might be looking at poetry, or you might even be looking at product design. But in some ways, the language, the metaphor, the analogies that are comfortable to you are drawing from this other field.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, you know, what do you feel you're carrying over from this experience of being immersed in the world of technology and robots that might work towards the next project or the project after that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, for me, because I write in different genres and forms, so I guess primarily it would be poetry or critical writing and increasingly nonfiction. I think I have learned by way of being obsessed, right, with robots, to that the robots and looking at these robots and writing about them haven't been in a void. So at the same time as I was writing these poems, I was also, you know, reading robotics, but I was also very intensely reading love poetry and the models of poems, what makes a love poem work, right, or not work, what are models. You know, I was reading all of Neruda's love poems, you know, that he wrote. And so, I mean, for me, it's always being able to, you know, think of things intersectionally, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just separate. So technology itself is never divorced from humanity. It's never divorced from the humanities as well.
Wow.
And so when I look at different things, even if it is a different topic, certainly being able to have a more expansive kind of landscape, right, when you're thinking about certain things or you're, you know, writing about things or the questions that you ask, I think that is what I would take away. It's that idea that it's not just interdisciplinary, but it's actually, you know, paradisciplinary, right? Because you're thinking about science and you're thinking about technology as well as these more traditional disciplines, like, you know, within the humanities.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it as paradisciplinary, but that's an interesting way to put it. But they run in parallel, I guess, is what you're saying?
Yeah, and also that it's, you know, we often think of things that you know, the sciences and technology really, I think, offer different kinds of models of how we can understand the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the humanities also do that too. So, you know, I think for me it is kind of, you know, and not to get so research focused, but like, It's kind of a methodology, you know, a methodology of how one is engaging, that it's not just inner, where it's like, you know, we would think of film and English as interdisciplinary in a way, possibly, right? But I think the sciences and the humanities the crossing of that. It's like this cross-pollination, right? And what kind of wonderful, beautiful, magical hybrid fruit do you that comes out of it, right? Like, and so I don't know. I guess I think about it in that sort of in that lens.
Mm-hmm. It's really exciting to think about it that way. And I do agree that there is a way in which these things, there is a cross-pollination, a way in which they inform and affect and influence, you know, what comes next. Looking at the clock, thinking about how we're winding down now. So I was wondering, perhaps as our final question or set of questions to think about, what would you say was the greatest surprise or discovery that you made in writing Love Robot?
That's a hard question. I have to take a moment with that. I think for me personally, I was surprised at how pleasurable it was to write the poems and to be thinking about robots, you know, deeply and all the time. So I didn't anticipate that. I mean, you know, how would one anticipate how fun it would be? But it really was quite fun, and it was very pleasurable. I could probably like read and think about robots all the time, but I guess that's it. I mean, for me personally, and then I guess, you know, I think in a more kind of, you know, broader context, I think what I was surprised about was when I finished the poems and I shared them with people, the feedback they often gave was like, you know, I'm not sure who is human or who is a robot, right, in the poems, because these are poems about a world where humans and robots fall in love and out of love with one another. And to me, that was really surprising, because I felt like I didn't anticipate that. But then I realized that they were totally right, because in a way, they all began to blur for me as well. And for the reader, when they, you know, brought it up to me, that it began to blur, that they weren't quite sure. I felt like that was kind of a really wonderful surprise for me to discover that I didn't purposely do that, you know, but that happened for the poem.
I think that's one of the magical things about that book, is that there is, it's on the tip of my tongue. I was just thinking, there's a very old, there's a classic tragic love story in Chinese, it's Chinese literature, and then they keep making movies about it. Liang Shanbo Zhu Ying Tai, and the, you know, they're ill-fated star-crossed lovers, and basically, you know, actually what I'm thinking of is a reference that then goes... That story then references an even older text. I think it's Zhuang Tai, the philosopher Zhuang Tai, who cannot distinguish. He wakes up one morning having had a dream, and he says he cannot tell if he was a man dreaming that he was a butterfly or a butterfly dreaming that he was a man.
Oh, wow.
And anyways, so the love story one, what happens, spoiler alert, is that having failed and having each of them died because they're not able to be with each other, they're reincarnated as butterflies that then fly off together. But then I kind of link the two things together. It's like there's this way in which one becomes the other, or one cannot distinguish the other. which is really interesting.
Yeah.
I am sorry to say we are out of time already. It has been such a wonderful delight to talk to you, Margaret, and to delve so deeply into this love of robots and the ways that in which this discussion has really revealed their humanity and our ties, our intertwining, our connection with the world of machines. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and for spending some time with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Late Night Literary Show or Late Night Literary Buffet or Late Night Lit Show, whatever we end up going with, here on KBOO, your community radio station. Coming up next is some radio theater on the Ubu Hour from 10 until midnight. So stay tuned for that. And before I go, I'd like to thank once more our guest for this evening, Naomi Hirahara, author of multiple mystery novels, including multiple mystery novels. You should check her out online. And Margaret Rhee, poet and scholar of robots and technology, race, gender, and society. So stay tuned for what's coming next. And this is Neil Akin. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.